Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Removing the stain of the Wounded Knee Massacre, a U.S. Supreme Court decision, and the Board of Regents meets today to discuss intellectual diversity. It's a full plate, and the Dakota political junkies are ready to dig in the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Rapid City studio. We have Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter Seth Tupper with us. Welcome back, Seth.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone from the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls, investigative reporter and columnist Jonathan Ellis. Thanks for taking the time today, Jonathan.
Happy to be here, Lori.
Seth, I want to start with you, and let's talk about the Wounded Knee Massacre, because I think a lot of people would be surprised that there were medals of honor given out after Wounded Knee. Tell us a little bit of the history before we get into what's happening in Congress today to have those medals rescinded.
The history of the massacre itself, or the history?
That's a big question. Yeah. The history of sort of, you know, who got the medals in the first place, and what do we know about why those medals were awarded that's different from how they're awarded today?
There's a great, if you go to our story about the effort to rescind the medals online, you'll find a link in the story to a research article that was published in a Nebraska Historical Society journal that outlines all of the medal winners that won the Medal of Honor for the Wounded Knee Massacre. But, they're rewarded for everything from a member, like a musician that was with the troops, all the way up to lieutenants, and for acts of what were called bravery, basically during this encounter. And obviously, as we look back now on this event, it was called a battle then; it's called a massacre now. But even some back then recognized it as a massacre. But this was an incident where nearly 400 Native Americans were killed, as opposed to about 30 soldiers. And of course, the soldiers were much better armed with large rapid-fire artillery guns. And this was an encampment of Native Americans who had basically surrendered and were being disarmed. Mm. And so,
women, children. Elderly and people, yes.
Yeah, all of the above. And you mentioned people would be surprised that there were medals of honor awarded. Funny story about that, when this current effort to rescind the medals began back in January, I'd called Representative Dusty Johnson, that was his reaction. He said, I asked him if a bill came forward, would he support it? This was way back in January. And his first response was something like, seriously, we gave medals of honor to, soldiers at Wounded Knee, and those are still valid? I said, yeah, we did. And he was so incredulous about it that he was really pestering me with questions like, are you sure about that? Is this legit? And I had to tell him, look, I'm not advising you on the historical accuracy of this, but I'm just telling you, yes, I'm sure. I'm sure. Right. And so that kind of indicates the hurdles you have to clear to get these medals rescinded is first, there's an education piece that obviously has to take place for people to understand what happened, that medals were in fact awarded, that they're still valid, et cetera.
So Seth, who is leading the charge in Congress now? Because it's not U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson.
Right. So this kind of, as I said, there's been past efforts to rescind these medals. This latest effort kind of coalesced in January after President Trump was criticizing a video that had been posted by Elizabeth Warren. And Elizabeth Warren has some, as we know now, some Native American ancestry quite a ways far back in her family tree. But President Trump has mockingly called her Pocahontas, and he did so in a tweet in January and even referenced Wounded Knee in kind of an offhanded way. And that sparked a backlash, and including from our Senator Rounds at the time tweeted that, Wounded Knee should never be used as a punchline. Mm-hmm. And that inspired a South Dakota nonprofit called the Four Directions, which has Native Americans and non-Native Americans involved in it that typically works for Native American voting rights. They got inspired to get involved in this and start a fresh drive to get the medals rescinded with the Trump tweet as the motivation. And so for the past 5 or 6 months, they've been sending letters and communicating with various members of Congress and the administration. And they got three members of Congress from of the House of Representatives from Washington, New Mexico, and California to sponsor a bill that has now been introduced this week to rescind these medals.
And to be clear, the medals themselves, the physical medals, do not have to be returned because that's impractical. So it's an administrative action. Let's bring Jonathan Ellis into the conversation. Jonathan, what kind of questions should people be asking right now in Congress when they, you know, bring up a bill such as this?
Well, I mean, a legitimate question. What actually took place, and you know, do we recognize the Medal of Honor for, you know, in today's standards, for, you know, that it, this is a medal that's awarded for extreme individual heroism on the battlefield. You look back at this, you know, 20 people getting it in 1890, I think very legitimately. You know, there's some questions about whether those should be rescinded. And, you know, it should be pointed out, too, it's not the first time that this has happened. I mean, in 1917, they reviewed reviewed a number of medals that had been given out previously all the way back to the Civil War and rescinded 911 medals that had been awarded. And it's important to know that, you know, in 1890, when these medals were awarded, I mean, it was obviously much, much easier to get a Medal of Honor. So I don't think it's out of line necessarily for us to stop and say, hey, look, this is a very important honor. There's probably no way under our standards today that any of those awards should probably stand. I mean, I've had the honor of writing a piece about Michael Fitzmaurice, who earned the medal in Vietnam, one of the few remaining, you know, living Medal of Honor winners. I mean, it's a sacred honor. And for these guys to have these awards, it just really, I think, casts a shadow over the likes of the people who earned those medals in subsequent wars. And really, many of them sacrificing themselves, you know, for their fellow soldiers and sailors and Marines.
So, Jonathan, why would you expect the South Dakota congressional delegation to sort of be on the sidelines in this effort, at least in these early days? This is something in South Dakota.
I mean, I would hope probably they wouldn't be. And as Seth pointed out, I mean, some people are probably surprised to learn in the first place that these awards were made in this incident. I mean, this is my opinion here, and I think that our congressional delegation over the years, whether it was Democrats or Republicans, has been pretty supportive of the military, and I think that you're supporting the military by not cheapening this award. And I think that, you know, it is a stain, and I think it's a stain on the Medal of Honor winners, you know, who won it in World War One, World War Two, all these other conflicts, who demonstrated extreme heroism. It's a stain on their sacrifice, on what they did, frankly, to have 20 people from the massacre have this award.
Right. I believe President Trump just bestowed a Medal of Honor on someone this week, I think, for heroism in rescuing a squad in Iraq. It still means something today.
It's an extremely meaningful award to those, you know, those of us who, you know, served in the military. Lori, you would know that. I mean, you know, that award is sacred. And for these guys to have these 20 awards to have been issued for this battle, it's just, to me, so going back to our congressional delegation, I mean, if you respect the integrity of this award, then, yeah, they should take a serious look at rescinding these 20 medals of honor.
And, Jonathan, you know that going in, too. It's always the joke, maybe some gallows humor, but people would always say there's two awards that you don't want, and one of them is the Medal of Honor, and the other is the Purple Heart. You know, I'll let those pass by because
I don't
necessarily need to be tested in that regard in this particular tour of duty, is what people would often say. Let's pivot here a little bit and talk, Jonathan, because you've definitely had a week of news with the Supreme Court decision going against the Argus Leader, trying to get businesses to have to give over their data about SNAP benefits and distribution of that money. That's kind of a big loss. What are some of the conversations that you've had in the newsroom with how are you processing that?
It wasn't totally unexpected following oral arguments in April. I mean, they had not necessarily gone our way. There were the number of the conservative justices on the court really seemed disinterested in seeing things our way. So, you know, I'd hoped that maybe we could get one of them to switch. But, yeah, I mean, they decided and it's not – I'm going to correct you. I'm going to correct the majority. It's not the business's data we wanted. It's our taxpayer money data that we wanted. What we spend as taxpayers to these businesses who have the privilege – of participating in a program that provides them tens of billions of dollars every year, so we lost that, and that's a major blow. It strikes a 45-year test regarding open records laws under the Freedom of Information Act, and now we kind of are where do we go from here? I mean, right. I think a lot of open government activists are. Now contemplating a long and bitter struggle in Congress to get this undone.
Yeah, point taken. Seth, thoughts this from your perspective?
Yeah, obviously all of us in the media were interested in this, and I'd just like to point out, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the Supreme Court's ruling in this, I think this is a good example of the media's importance to society and a democracy is that as an American citizen, it's good for you to have members of the media persistently pushing against the government and demanding access to information. If you don't have that, there's a tendency for the government to just think that, well, everything's closed until you can pry it out of my hands. And obviously, as we've seen with this decision, we don't always win when we take on these fights, but it's important and somewhat comforting to know, I think, that there are people out there waging these battles and, at least putting the government on notice that, look, we're going to demand this information and we're going to keep going. And I have no doubt that, you know, people who are committed to these kinds of openness issues will keep going, and Jonathan will keep going, the Argus will keep going. And it's disappointing to lose, but it's also, as I said, it's important to keep pushing for greater transparency.
All right, let's talk a little bit about intellectual diversity and the South Dakota Board of Regents. You know, we're approaching that July 1st deadline when legislation takes effect, and some things that we talked about in January and February and March are once again top of mind. Jonathan, where do you want to start with wrestling with what intellectual diversity on college campuses and public institutions really is?
Well, yeah, I've been listening actually all morning to the Board of Regents take testimony on this issue, and they hadn't. Now, with the law that passed and that goes into effect July 1, they're going to have to try to, you know, come to terms with what they need to do to follow that law. And so part of that will be gathering metrics, for example, on submitting reports to the governor's office about what they've done to try to promote intellectual diversity. And so today you had hearings in which there were national people in, you had different groups in advocating for what should be done, what should not be done. Interestingly, you had a couple members of the Board of Regents express some skepticism about, well, what do we really have this issue? I mean, you had the board president, Kevin Schieffer, who called himself a conservative Republican. Of course, we all know that he'd served for many years under Senator Larry Pressler, chief of staff for Larry Pressler. And, so he's like, I'm a conservative Republican. Do we really have an issue with, he said, I don't doubt that academia is probably has sort of left, is dominated by a left wing, but do we really have an issue in South Dakota with, examples of, free speech rights being trampled, those kinds of things? And, I think some of the response from some of the national people who were here to testify in favor of the intellectual diversity bill was like, well, you're maybe not as far down that path as some other places, but yeah, it's something that you have to watch out for. So, The board is really going to grapple with how to deal with intellectual diversity while at the same time wanting to be make sure that the schools are welcoming to people of all different cultures and backgrounds. So this is something that they're going to struggle, I think, over the next few months to kind of flesh out what it is, what their obligations are under the law, and what they have to do to get that done.
What are we watching out for, Seth? When someone says, you have to watch out for this, what exactly are they talking about?
Well, I think the broader issue to watch out for here that's interesting to me is just that I don't know. I've just been curious. Is it, if we're talking about freedom of speech and guaranteeing freedom of speech, is it a great idea for the government to pass more laws and control more things regarded to freedom of speech if you want that speech to be free? It's sort of a curious approach, you know, from my perspective from afar, is that we're getting more and more and more, we're getting more legislators more involved, we're getting bureaucrats more involved in something that we want to be free. And there are obviously some ways that that could go wrong, I think, if, as we move forward.
So they're watching out for it being too free, too not free enough. Too,
well,
one side.
We all know just, what the is at the base of this is people on both sides of the political divide. You know, thinking that one side thinking that they're not their perspective hasn't been allowed the freedom that the other has, and in some cases that may be true. I don't know, but it's again, it's curious to me that the answer has become more government involvement in freedom of speech.
And Jonathan, I was off yesterday, so I didn't get to look this up. So if I'm on a goose chase here, just, you know, wave me off. But wasn't there some kind of comment about the diversity officers and the value of them as well from state lawmakers saying that maybe they shouldn't be there? They weren't doing their jobs. I mean, how in the weeds are we getting with how individual universities are dealing with the diversity?
Well, yeah. Some lawmakers have expressed concerns about the diversity offices and whether there's sort of the nexus of sort of the left-wing social justice movements and things like that that then are hostile to free, you know, to conservative free speech. That's their suggestion. You know, on the other hand, others are saying, well, no. I mean, the diversity offices are supposed to be welcoming for, you know, international students, students of color, things like that. And so, you have a debate about what those offices, what they're doing, what they should be doing. And again, that came up today. And again, Kevin Schieffer is, you know, he's saying, well, can't we just make sure that the diversity offices are, you know, representing everybody, and, you know, so they're again kind of grappling with how to deal with these requests from lawmakers. The concern among the Board of Regents about whether they're going to be spending a bunch of money to create new bureaucracies to fulfill this. But I would expect maybe to see, I wouldn't be surprised out of what I heard today to see that maybe the board might have a firm hired out of state firm or out of the board control firm to come in and maybe do a survey of students to feel like if they feel like they are, you know, self-censoring or those kinds of things. So I think that that's kind of the starting place for where the board will go with trying to maybe pull students and collect some data there.
And that's getting back to the same issue of what exactly is the problem, but the legislation was already passed to solve the problem that we're not sure is a problem.
Well, I mean, the legislation. Yeah,
help me out. You know, you take a day off and you get confused about these things.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting pieces, and again, from the data perspective that I enjoy messing with the data. I mean, the legislation might be useful in the sense that it will allow them or encourage, or I guess really force them to collect data to see whether this is an issue. I mean, there's no question that there have been some egregious examples in other parts of the country of free speech violations, and I think that, you know, and certainly what lawmakers are doing here, you would say, is very reactionary to what's happened to other places.
Oh. Is this tied into the USD pineapple party?
No, in fact, Kevin Schieffer today said that was all kind of a made-up deal,
okay.
not a free speech issue.
All right, we're tossing the political pineapple. Anything else that we want to talk about before we let you go? Seth Tupper, what do you have your eyes on coming up in the week ahead?
Boy, I don't know. I'm so busy recovering from yesterday.
The head is still spinning from all these things. Well, you gentlemen do great work every day. You can find it at rapidcityjournal.com for Seth Tupper and argusleader.com for Jonathan Ellis. Follow them both on Twitter as well. Seth, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Jonathan, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks, Lori.